News, I'm Michael Brown. The Trump administration says it's moving to conduct interviews of immigrants seeking asylum within one calendar day. Asylum officers usually wait about 48 hours to interview and hear the case of an immigrant who has been detained after crossing into the United States. The policy change, first reported on BuzzFeed News, said advocates believe the move is expected to give immigrants less time to prepare for their interviews or recover from the dangerous journeys. The credible fear interview is an initial screening where immigrants must show there is a compelling chance they will be persecuted or can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country. But by law, asylum seekers have a right to consult with a person or persons of their choosing before a hearing. The U.S. returning a group of asylum seekers from Nuevo Laredo, Mexico. Get more on the story from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Under the so-called Remain in Mexico program, 10 migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. were sent to Nuevo Laredo, Mexico for the first time Tuesday. Nuevo Laredo was added to the program after the U.S. and Mexico reached an agreement heading off threatened tariffs on Mexican exports last month. The program was already operating in the Mexican border cities of Tijuana, Mexicali, and Ciudad Juarez. Also Tuesday, U.S. Customs and Border Protection announced migrant apprehensions along the southwest border dropped 28% in June compared to May. I'm Mike Rossia.
President Trump says he will no longer deal with Britain's ambassador to Washington after the key envoy disparaged him as incompetent. British officials are scrambling to find the source of a leak of Kim Darroch's diplomatic cables from Washington to his homeland. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Two-thirds of all mass attacks in the United States last year were carried out by someone who was experiencing mental health problems. That's just one of the findings in a new report by a unit within the Secret Service. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
The study done by the National Threat Assessment Center finds similarities among those who carried out attacks in 2018. They include nearly all of them making threats or concerning statements before their attacks. Two-thirds had mental health issues, most of the attackers were male, and a third of them had a history of domestic violence. The center says the study is designed for both law enforcement and civilians to be more aware to avert more attacks in the future.
That was Tim McGuire reporting. The United States says that its arms sale to Taiwan is aimed at promoting peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region, and Washington is not changing its One China policy. China has demanded the U.S. cancel the sale after the State Department approved a request by Taiwan to purchase an estimated $2.2 billion worth of military equipment. A State Department official told VOA the approved sale is consistent with U.S. law and policy. The potential deal has angered China, Taiwan's bitter cross-strait rival. A U.S. court ruling that it is unconstitutional for President Trump to block critics on Twitter has reignited criticism of politicians who ban detractors from their social media accounts. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York ruled unanimously on Tuesday that because Trump's Twitter account is a public forum, he can block users who disagree with him. Trump has used Twitter to make on-the-fly policy, lash out at his critics, and voice his opinion on virtually every subject. Trump is not the only politician sued over blocking social media critics. The American Civil Liberties Union is suing officials in Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, and Virginia on behalf of constituents who were blocked on social media. And the Trump administration is urging Turkey to stop oil and gas drilling off the coast of the divided islands of Cyprus. The U.S. State Department says the provocative step raises tensions in the region and that the island's oil and gas reserves, like all of its resources, should be equitably shared between both communities in the context of an overall settlement. Cyprus has been split by Turkish Cypriot North and Greek Cypriot South since 1974, when Turkey sent troops to the island in response to a Greek military coup. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, July 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A two-day regional conference on counterterrorism gets underway today and the national at the United Nations office in Nairobi.
The problem we have today in the world is the number of young people that cannot find a job after they conclude school. And obviously this creates many frustrations. Easiest way for many to look into a difficult situation that they face is to try to find a scapegoat.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Some internet has been restored in Sudan as military and protesters are set to sign a power-sharing agreement today, Wednesday. South Sudan President apologizes for his government's failure to pay civil servants' salaries. And who is responsible for the postponement of Monday's Liberia senatorial by-election?
You are conducting the process under an extremely difficult economic situation. So if you have a tight economic situation like what we have here, who is responsible for that? Well, I can't discount it. I don't know.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. And we will get analysis of the West Africa common currency. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A two-day United Nations-sponsored regional conference on counterterrorism gets underway today in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. It will bring together heads of government and ministers of interior, security, and foreign affairs. As Maureen Ojiambo reports, the conference will also be attended by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The two-day high-level meeting that kicks off today is set to see the international community, civil society, and United Nations member states coming together to fight terrorism. Speaking in Nairobi at Kamkunji constituency yesterday, Tuesday, during a meeting with members of the public, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that youth involvement in matter security will help in fighting violent extremism among the young generation.
But young generations are sometimes in very difficult circumstances. Kenya is a country with a large population. I believe this neighborhood has a large youth population. And the worst problem we have today in the world, for me, is youth unemployment. It's the number of young people that cannot find a job after they conclude school. And obviously, this creates many frustrations. Easiest way for many to look into a difficult situation that they face is to try to find a scapegoat.
Most of the youths, especially from low-income families, have been falling prey of violent extremism. And Guterres' visit to Kamukunji Isli in Nairobi was to talk to the young generation on the radicalization which is on the rise in Kenya. Fozia Ali, a Kamukunji resident and representative from Women International Security Organization, says that efforts have been put in place to curb the insecurity in the area and that youth involvement might be of help.
When people hear about Kamukunji and especially Isli, they hear stories that are negative. They hear that this is a place where violence happens. This is a place where the stories around hard security is found. In terms of today is more about a leap forward of lessons that were learned because of the challenges we faced. This is the space where we worked with teachers to form Teachers Against Violent Extremism.
Today's conference in Nairobi will enable African leaders to share practices in countering terrorism. Athman Ahmed, who used social media to reach out on young generation, said that he has managed to mobilize youths on his social media platform to see radicalization reduces among the youths.
Social media is a very important tool. When does it happen? We came out in large numbers again through social media mobilization, and we are condemned terrorism in all forms. And honestly, most of the time people attack us for coming out and condemning these things.
However, Mr. Guterres urged the organization working to ensure violent extremism is curbed to apply different mechanisms.
Prevention of violent extremism, about youth mobilization, about social media, about peace building, about all the other aspects that were referred, show that this is a community that is a strategy. And that strategy is global. Innovation. You are thinking out of the box. You are not doing things as everybody else does. And this is how you will be able to succeed.
President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya African leaders, diplomats, among other dignitaries, are set to attend the two-day event on violent extremism affecting African nations. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Some internet service has reportedly been restored in Sudan following a court order to end the blackout. The military authorities imposed the blackout in June for what they said was security concerns. Meanwhile, the ruling military council and protesters are expected to sign a power-sharing agreement today, Wednesday. Elami Shingraya is a member of the political bureau of the 27 November movement.
I think that agreement will be the first step to stable the life of the old Sudanese people after 30 years of suffering under the rule of the tyrant Omar al-Bashir. I think that will be a positive step. Even we have grudges and we have some difficult and hard feeling in our heart because of the losses of the young men and women that we lost last month. More than 150, but still we look in the whole picture. The whole picture still holds a huge, big hope for a new start for our people and for our country.
Prior to this agreement being reached, the debate was about who should be represented in the council. How many military, how many civilians? What do you know about the composition of this council?
Yeah, the council, five of the military, and I expect the commander of the military now and the current leader now, General Al-Burhan, will be one of them. And the other one of the five, General Hemeti, the head of the Rabat forces, Rabat Response Force. There is another three of them. Still there is people here and there are talking about the nomination of some names. And from the civilian side, originally the idea was to represent the six state or the six region of Sudan. There is a Darfur region, Kordofan region, and the middle region of Sudan, and the north region, and the eastern region. And from each region, they should nominate someone well-known by his political participation and a person with wisdom, because the Sovereignty Council is not an executive council. It is not a day-to-day job. It is about more about wisdom and about bringing the people together. So far, there is a nominee. Some names have been people start to talk about them. One of them, a professor from University of Khartoum, and her name is Professor Fadwa. And there is some names also from Kordofan and Darfur. Moreover, should I say it or no? I don't know, but I had been nominated also myself, Al-Amin Shingray, for that council to represent the eastern three states, state of Al-Gadarif and Red Sea state and state the Kassala.
So let me say, congratulations. First of all, congratulations for being nominated.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, there's some other news about Sudan
that the
internet that had been kind of taken offline had been, some of it had been restored. What do you think that means?
I think that is a good step and a good sign. That means there is initial agreement on the basis of the agreement between the military and the civilian and the activists. And let me go back to the nomination thing. Still, there is a committee there in Khartoum, and that committee will look in all the names. People just nominate whoever they like and they think that is good, but that committee will make the last decision. Until this moment, we don't know what is the last list that had been chosen by that committee. And by any way, we will cooperate with them, and because it is for the sake of our country and our peaceful future of our people.
Mr. Elamy Chagraya, thank you very much. It's so nice always to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Elamy Chagraya is a member of the Political Bureau of the 27 November Movement of Sudan. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C., today's Wednesday, July 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 and a half minutes past the hour. South Sudan President Salva Kiir, yesterday, Tuesday, pardoned 15 inmates who had been serving various sentences in Juba, addressing the nation on the country's 8th independence anniversary. The president also admitted that the country is facing an economic crisis and apologized for his government's failure to pay the salaries of its employees on time. Wake Simon will do reports from Juba.
Most Juba shops and offices are closed and streets are quiet as South Sudanese mark Independence Day. The government did not organize any official celebrations to commemorate the day. President Kiir was quick to defend that decision in his speech.
I believe the importance of our Independence Day is not measured by whether we observe or celebrate it, but by the value we the people of South Sudan, attach to its achievement and the huge sacrifice we have made in the course of our long struggle. I therefore salute you today on the occasion of the 8th anniversary of our hard and independence.
Kiir says financial constraints prompted the decision to halt no official celebration. Mr. Kiir encouraged all South Sudanese to embrace peace.
Peace is extremely important for our security, stability, and prosperity, my fellow citizens. And I want all of us to encourage our sons and daughters to embrace and maintain the peace which the revitalized agreement has given us. The people of South Sudan have seen for themselves what war has done in our country over the long span of our liberation struggle.
2 months into the six-month extension of the pre-transition period, CITESAM, the body responsible for monitoring implementation of the peace agreement, warned last week that the parties could miss the November deadline for wrapping up pre-transitional activities. Desta Abiche, CITESAM chairman, said the parties have yet to canton all their forces, one of the key components of the security arrangements spelled out in the peace agreement. Kiir says he is confident it will happen.
I have no doubt that with the full implementation of the revitalized agreement, security will return to South Sudan. Our economy will thrive, and we will be able to better deliver services to our people, such as schools, hospitals, clean drinking water, and create jobs for the people of South Sudan.
The president says he is fully aware that citizens are angry over their difficult living conditions caused by insecurity and economic hardships, which he apologized for in today's speech.
This is further exacerbated by the failure of my government to pay salaries of our civil servants on time. However, that salary may be little, it does make some difference in the livelihood of the families of our civil servants. I want to sincerely apologize to you, my people, on my own behalf and on behalf of the government for those failures.
The release of several inmates excludes prominent peace activist Peter Beer and a businessman Kerbino Wall, both of whom were found guilty of causing chaos during the October uprising at Juba's National Security Service headquarters, known as the Blue House. Beer was sentenced to 2 years in prison, and Wall was sentenced to a combined 13 years in prison for allegedly masterminding the uprising. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Liberia's Elections Commission Chief Jerome Kokoya says the senatorial and representative by-elections that were postponed to Monday could be held sometime before the end of this month. But Mr. Kokoya, who would not say whether his commission or the Liberian government was responsible for the postponement. He says Liberia has been going through some economic difficulties.
What is responsible for the postponement is that certain materials that we ordered and necessary for the contracting process could not get here on time. So the vendor encountered some problems. And so we are still working with the vendor to correct the situation. And as soon as we can do so, we'll be coming out of a new date.
Some people say because of the lack of funding. In that case, who is responsible for the delay?
The reason I prefer not to play the blame game is that sometimes we like to be realistic. You are conducting the process under the extremely difficult economic situations. So if you have a tight economic situation like what we have here, who is responsible for that? Well, I can't discuss it. I don't know. So indeed, there have been funding problems. But I don't want to discuss it in a context like somebody deliberately neglected to do something. I do know that the government were trying to make the resources available. Of course, it didn't come on time because of what I have just referred to.
Mr. Chairman, what do you know about these reports of secret voter registration?
I read in the papers today. That's sheer nonsense, James. The Election Commission is one of the most, if not the most, transparent organizations. We manage a process that we do own. The process belongs to the Liberian people. So we recognize our limitations. Whatever we do it in the open. There is nothing called secrecy at the commission. What has happened is that during election time, we do voter card replacement. People who destroy or mislead their voter cards. So the law provides that a voter has a right to replace his or her lost or damaged card anytime upon the payment of a minimum fee of $5. But during election, some of our people, because of other reasons, do not get to replace their damaged car because of economic situation. So whenever we have the time and the resources, we organize a process whereby we replace their cars free of charge. Now, let me say that replacement of cars completely different from voter registration. When you do registration, you add. You include voters. When you do car replacement, you don't add. You maintain the same number of voters, and you simply change cards for those people who are already in the system. That's what was taking place during this by-election. So I asked the minister if they could fund it. The minister said, okay, we can do that. At that time, we are already close to the schedule, the time we allow for the car replacement. So we extended it by 2 days, and the 2 days were supposed to be free. Because of that, the fact that were free would increase the standards. So most of the people that could not afford came over. So the crowd were heavy, and some of them came from different places. They thought that were registering people. So we said, no, this is just car replacement. So Martin Riley alone got 778,000 registered voters. Of that, we were able to replace a total of 1,600. That's nothing. Then people going around say, oh, because the people doing secret things, nobody doing anything secret. The voter roll remains the same.
I did speak to the opposition leader, Alexander Cummings, and he suggested that this delay was an attempt on the part of the ruling party to buy time so that they could steal the election. The other rumor I'm hearing is that perhaps you, the election commission chairperson, might have been compromised. Some people suggest that maybe you want to be the next ambassador.
Well, I don't know, I speak for the ruling party because I'm not a member of the ruling party. I'm not a politician. So I don't know what Mr. Cummings knows about the ruling party so they can address it. But for the election commission and for myself, I tell you that that's sheer nonsense. I cannot be compromised. The election commission operates, like I said, in a transparent way. The control mechanism under which the election commission operates is so tight, so clear, that anybody who understands, if Mr. Cummings, I didn't listen to him, but if he did say that, then probably he is not familiar with the way the commission operates.
That was Liberian Elections Commission Chief Jerome Kokoya. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. 15 West African countries have agreed to use a single currency, which will be known as the ECO by 2020. Some skepticism remains if the countries will be able to meet the guidelines to launch this, as past deadlines have been delayed. Abdullah Rashid Issa, an economics professor at the Nile University in Nigeria, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the background of these efforts, the possible benefits, and the potential pitfalls.
The first idea maybe came up in 1999 during one of the summits of the ECOWAS head of state, and they released a document. So the discussion started in 2000, but deadline has been postponed like four times, I think, 2004, 2009, I think recently, 2013 probably. So the main reason, I think, has been lack of political will.
Why do you think the political will is here now? And there is a lot of talk, at least in the Francophone countries, of why they need to leave the CFA franc and have more control over their currency.
The AFCFTA just came, it said it is operational phase. Almost all countries in Africa have joined that. So this has never been seen before. African countries now are coming to terms with the fact that for them to grow their economies and create jobs and solve poverty, they need to build a strong manufacturing base.
What kind of potential problems could arise from going to this single currency zone with countries that have wide range of infrastructure? You know, Liberia is not the same as Nigeria, is not the same as Senegal, etc.
Yes. So definitely there are challenges ahead of the ECO. We need a strong commitment in order to overcome them. One challenge over the years has been ECOWAS convergence criteria. So this is like a list of 10 conditions that member countries are expected to meet before a single currency is formed. And these include having a single-digit inflation rate and also a fiscal deficit that is less than 4% of GDP. So fiscal deficit means the difference between budget expenditure and budget revenue.
That was Abdul Rashid Issa, an economics professor at Nile University in Nigeria. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Abuja. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. A two-day United Nations-sponsored regional conference on counterterrorism gets underway today in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. It will bring together heads of government and ministers of interior security and foreign affairs. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres will also be in attendance. Some internet service has reportedly been restored in Sudan following a court order to end the blackout. The military authorities imposed the blackout in June for what they said was security concerns. Meanwhile, the ruling military council and protesters are expected to sign a power-sharing agreement today, Wednesday. As an estimated 6.7 million Tunisian voters prepare to head to the polls to elect their next government later this year, a growing fear of terrorist attacks could risk undermining the democratic process in North African country. Some analysts warn two suicide attackers blew themselves up in two separate bombings against police in the capital, Tunis, on June 27. Leaving at least one police officer dead and injuring eight people, a third suicide bombing occurred on July 2nd after a militant surrender by police blew himself up. That is it for this Wednesday, July 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington wishing you a very good day.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.